Hi there, and welcome to My Cape York Life, stories from the people who live on and care for Cape York Peninsula.
Oh, there was a white-breasted sea eagle just downstream that was looking for some breakfast, and there's a wampu pigeon calling across here. It's just absolutely paradise.
Cowan is about 500-600 km north of Cairns, right in the centre of Cape York. You can't miss it. You've got to go through it to get to Weipo or anywhere up north.
It's always been home for me, and I've been here with my grandparents and all that, and yeah, I'm glad to be working here.
Just understand that this country's pretty special, and if you bugger it up, you're not going to get it back. Once it's gone, it's gone.
When the road was bad, everyone used to buy cartons of everything. When I first went to Crocodile, all the tin fruit and the tin jams had no labels on them. Billy Wallace used to pull all the labels off because everyone would eat all the good jam first.
That was my sole life, living on the little farm out there. My father grew seed, and my mother worked in at the hospital, so we lived that far out of town that Mum didn't even come home between shifts. She only came home for her days off.
You know, people come up to Cooktown on their way to Cape York, or they come up to Cooktown to come and visit, and then they come up here and they realise, oh, I wish we'd stayed longer. You know, the landscapes are so beautiful and the history is so interesting.
I think so. Cape York's a bit like that. It gets in your blood.
About 15,000 people live on Cape York Peninsula, and every dry season, tens of thousands more visit the region. 60 to 70,000 visitors a year is not uncommon. And one of the big reasons they come here is to see the plants and wildlife. The amazing diversity of flora and fauna that thrives or survives in the savanna country, the rainforests, the wetlands, and Queensland's longest stretch of coastline that make up Cape York Peninsula. That incredible diversity attracts scientists, researchers, and wildlife experts from all over the world. And a fair number of them will make their way here to meet Lewis Roberts on the family farm at Chipton's Flat, south of Cooktown. Lewis is an entirely self-taught naturalist and botanical illustrator. Lewis and his brother Charlie are widely regarded as experts on southern Cape York plants and animals, although Lewis is far too modest for such recognition. He's lived his whole life here at Chipton's Flat, raising cattle and walking the country. He has plants and animals named after him, and he's been honoured with a Medal of the Order of Australia. I'm sitting next to the creek on a warm, wet season afternoon. There's an occasional breeze, the cattle are strolling by, and those cicadas. And Lewis is telling me the story of his family and of Chipton's Flat, a story that goes back well over 100 years.
Well, my name is Lewis Roberts, and I've lived here at Chipton's Flat all my life. I'm the third generation of us here, actually. And we're sitting on the bank of Parrot Creek, which is a tributary of the Annan River. Our family has lived here for about a century or a bit better, I guess. And yeah, originally it was a mining area. Our grandparents came here mining tin, and about when the last war was on, the tin had sort of petered out, so it became solely a cattle property then. So we just grew up here, you know, and got to know all the wildlife and stuff around the countryside. So that was the start of our career in wildlife and on the land, I guess.
So I'm sitting here this morning with Lewis Roberts, and we're in this beautiful part of Cape York, which is sort of down to the southeast, just south of Cooktown. We're in a beautiful spot by the creek that you just spoke about, Lewis. Can you tell us, just describe a little bit about the environment that we're sitting in?
Well, it was basically all open forest country here. Some of it's become a bit more overgrown with undergrowth these days, but this we've maintained sort of in its original state where we're sitting. It's fairly open still. The grass is not as long as it was when we were kids because we've just come through a bit of a drought here, but soon it'll be the same, hopefully. And, yeah, there was a little bit of gallery forest along the creek here, and there's little patches of rainforest all through the area. And if you want to go for a walk, you can go up onto the mountain, which goes up above 1,000 metres, and, you know, that covers a lot of different habitat. You can see birds and mammals and reptiles and things that occur above 600 metres and are more common of the Atherton Tableland area and places like that. But it's a great place for birds and, you know, the northern bird life and mammals and things. Tree kangaroos come along the creek here and are all through this area.
So can you tell us the name of the property here?
Shipton's Flat is the name of the property. Originally it was there were two brothers, I believe, the name was Shipton, and it was confined to this actual flat here. There's a kind of a valley here with a flat bottom. It probably had something to do with the volcanic cone here. It must have blocked off a bit of a drainage system or something and caused this flat area in amongst the hills. And then in later times it became the cattle property, which doubled, or, you know, made it a much bigger area. And these days it's called Shipton's Flat, right from the Mulligan Highway to Mount Poverty, I think. But really, this was Shipton's Flat right here.
And how big is this property?
We've got about 1,000 hectares in Shipton's Flat itself. It had a few other leases which made it a lot bigger at one stage, but it's basically called Shipton's Flat, the cattle property.
And how many cattle have you got on here now? And have you raised cattle the whole time you've been here, and your family before, your parents before you?
Yes, that was all we did in my time. I had a little mine back in the 70s working tin up at Mount Romeo, but basically I've run cattle here all my life. We normally run about 500 head, but we haven't got that many at the moment because we've had some bad years of drought and we've had to cut back on the cattle a bit, so we're sort of, you know, struggling a bit in some ways.
It's January here, January in 2017, at the start of the year, and it's also the wet season's kicked off finally, and you've had a little bit of rain here?
Yes, we've had good rain in the last week, and up till then it was really dry here. There wasn't a speck of green to be seen in the grass, so we're very thankful for this, but normally we would have expected storms around November or something. It's been a long dry season actually.
So can you tell us a little bit about, you grew up here and we've just had a cup of tea in your beautiful house, which looks like it's the original homestead. And so it must have been pretty awesome living in this part of the world, and not many people around, I imagine, as you were growing up. And what was it like growing up here, and where did you go to school, and what kinds of things did you do as a kid?
Well, we did correspondence school here. Our mother taught us at home, and we thought it was great living out here in the country. Had the whole, you know, area for miles and miles to ourselves. So we probably grew up like wild kids, I guess. But we used to roam all through the bush. I guess that's why we can find our way in without getting lost. But I thought it was great. We learned that, you know, what all the birds and mammals and things were, and we've sort of continued with our interest in that sort of thing. Mum and Dad were quite interested in the wildlife and that too. Dad had quite a bit of connection with the Museum of Natural History in America before I was born, I should say, because they were here in 48 or something. But that probably was a bit of a foundation for our interest, I guess, because they encouraged us quite a bit. Yeah, and we walked up the mountains here, which, as I said, go to above 1,000 metres, some of them, so there's plenty of scope for variation in the wildlife. If you go inland a bit, you get all the dry country animals and birds, and, you know, we get pretty severe dry seasons here sometimes, and we get, well, birds in particular that you don't normally see here at that time of the year.
So you're a would you describe yourself as a self-taught naturalist?
Yes, I guess so, because everything we do, we taught ourselves more or less. We had to, I guess, the way we used to live, all our own mechanical work and that, we had to do it or it didn't get done. And we sort of become a bit of a jack of all trades, I guess.
And how did you learn? How do you learn those things?
Just experience. There's no other way here.
So after school, so what year level did you go through to? Well, through your correspondence, and your mum taught you. So you did your schooling and then you worked on the property?
Yes, we were working on the property before we finished school, of course, because that was just part of our life here. I can't remember. I think we went to grade 9 or something like that. Just the basic necessities, probably.
And then what? So your interest in natural history obviously grew quite a bit, and you've you know quite a bit, I understand, about the native vegetation and wildlife that are here. And so how did that grow, and how did you develop that interest?
Well, as I said, we sort of got to know everything that was here, that was obvious anyway, and we used to get all these scientists from Brisbane and other parts of the world would be here looking for some particular bird or animal or reptile or insect or something, and we used to just take them out and show them, and that's how it started, really. We still do get a lot of people like that, actually. If they come from Brisbane or America or somewhere to here looking for some little obscure animal or flower or something, they probably would never find it. But if they know someone that knows where it is, they just get on to us and we show it to them. So they often name something after us because we showed them the thing, or sometimes we actually knew of something no one else knew about and we would just mention it to them and get them onto it, and they would describe it. So yeah, that's how it all eventuated.
Can you tell us about some of the things that you had named after you?
Well, there's been quite a few. There was a blind snake I happened to come across one day, and they named it Rampetiplos Robert's Eye, and there was some orchids too that I knew about for quite some time, actually, and eventually I got some people in Canberra to give them a name. One of them was quite a dramatically unusual orchid. They actually created a new genus for it as well, so it was called Cooktownia Robert's Eye, which was quite a triumph, I guess. They tried to describe it in another genus, but it was so different that the publishers wouldn't accept it, so they had to create a genus for it.
So can you tell us what that looks like?
Well, you'd be disappointed if you saw it, because it's a bit of an obscure-looking thing, and the flower is not very spectacular, but it's a little terrestrial orchid related to the habenarias that grows about probably 30 centimetres tall and has about up to a dozen small green flowers. They're pretty insignificant, they're very small, but it's an unusual plant. It doesn't seem to have any close relations, and it seems to have a bit of an unusual method of pollination or something too, so it's quite interesting. And there's been a few insects and that which were just casually collected by myself or someone else in the family when we were helping somebody do something else, and I believe some of those have been called Robert's Eye or something similar too. Also a few plants. There was a little bush up on Mount Finnegan called Zaire. I took a guy up there back in the 60s, I guess, or early 70s, and he described it as a subspecies of Zaire, but in later times it was raised to species level and it's now called Robertsauriums.
Oh wow.
That's how some of these things happen.
That's pretty special.
Yeah, well, it's nice to go up there and say, oh, that plant there is named after me.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the blind snake? Because that's not something that you would come across every day. They're pretty rare, aren't they?
Well, even the common ones appear to be rare because they live underground and, you know, in places where no one sees them much, then even the common ones are not often seen. And this one, it does appear to be particularly rare because they haven't been able to find it anywhere since. That doesn't mean it's not there, though. It's probably quite common if you could only find them. But no, so far no one has. But it's quite a nice-looking one. It's black above and white below, which is not real common in those sort of reptiles. So, yeah, it's a distinctive species at least.
And so, I mean, growing up here, you get to know this piece of country that you've lived and breathed all of your life. Did you, you would have known, what was it when you first started to find new things that you knew, oh yeah, this was the time when you saw something new and you'd bring it home to idea it, or how did you do that? Like, how did you know instinctively when you came across something that, oh, I haven't seen this here before?
Well, with plants and things like orchids, we used to bring the flower home and check it out in some of the reference books. Because of Mum's interest in that sort of thing, we did have some good reference books. And if it wasn't in it, we said, well, it's most likely an undescribed or unknown orchid or plant or whatever, and usually it turned out it was. So yes, that's how it mostly came about. I was quite interested in reptiles, so I recognised the blind snake straight away as being a different one to the known species. And that has happened with some other reptiles and things as well, because I had a first-hand knowledge of the reptiles.
I've heard also that you're quite a highly skilled botanical artist.
Well, I don't know about highly skilled, but
I heard you're very good.
I do have done a bit of for my own use, orchid illustrations in particular. When I was collecting flowers for those people in Canberra, they used to send me a black and white line drawing of the, anything a bit unusual, and I thought some of them looked a bit rough, so I thought, well, maybe I could do my own, and I did start doing my own just as a reference sort of collection, and there were some bird people here that I was taking around, and I showed them to them because some of them were interested in orchids too, and they said, why don't you colour them? And they actually sent me some pads and things to do it with, so I did try it, and they looked so good that I started all over again, but it became a much more elaborate sort of a job then, whereas I was doing two or three line drawings in a day if I wanted to. Mm. It became about a 3 or 4 day episode to illustrate them correctly, and anyway, I did do about 125 or something because of orchids up here, so I was going quite well on it, but in late years I haven't had much time to get onto that. I would like to get back onto it, though.
How do the illustrations get used?
Well, they haven't been used at all yet, except they had them on. They have got some at the powerhouse in Cooktown, which they put on display now and then. They're actually copies, the ones there. But apparently they attract a lot of interest, and they put them up every now and then, I guess.
I'm sure they do. We'll have to try and get a book together of your illustrations.
Well, I was hoping to do all the orchids of Cape York at one stage, but I'm beginning to doubt that I'll ever manage it now. I was going quite okay for a long time. It seems to have come to a bit of a stop at the moment.
So is that, I think you said 125, that or thereabouts, that you've done so far, is that how many different species then, or?
There's about another 125 to go. So I'm a long way from being completed, unfortunately.
And do you have any particular favourites?
No, not really. I tried to do the ones that I had brought to light, and I think I have got most of those done. But I did do some of the rarer ones from further up the peninsula, and there are a lot of common ones around here that I didn't do because I thought I'll leave them till I need something that's not so hard to come by and I can't travel or something. So if I did get back onto them, I might have a chance of, a better chance of finishing them.
I was having a bit of a chat with Shelley earlier, and she was telling me that you used to do some work with DPI around the papaya fruit fly time, and that you used to put traps in some pretty unusual places.
Yeah, I was involved in that fruit fly eradication thing that time, which was highly successful, surprisingly. At the time, I didn't think we had much chance, but yeah, I used to go down to Cedar Bay and empty the traps there, and we had a regular trap run for nearly every day of the week, to Laura or Cape Trib or up the Endeavour or somewhere. So, yeah, for a year or two there, I had a fairly busy time.
And, Lewis, I hear that you do a lot of your work on foot, so you're walking into a lot of these places. You must be pretty fit because, we've got, as you said before, the mountain over the back here is over 1,000 metres high, and you're going into some pretty wild and remote and thick rainforest country as well, so you must be a pretty fit person.
Well, I don't know. I don't feel that fit, but I suppose I must be because people have trouble keeping up. But yeah, I've been to the top of nearly all the mountains around North Queensland, and I've walked about to the most remote places you can fine. I've been all through the Palmer and everywhere on bushwalks and the like. So, yeah, I guess I can say I've done a lot of walking.
Yeah. And do you have a favourite place, or is there anything that stands out in all the trips you've done around the Cape and the different places that you've been that stands out for you?
Well, there are a few, yes. I kind of like rocks, so Cape Melville is one of my favourite places, and Mount Peter Bot, if you ever get up there, it's all out of this world.
Whereabouts is that? Tell us about that.
That's just inland from Cape Tribulation. Up on Mount Thornton nearby is another really, really spectacular place that I really like. But it is hard to pick out one particular place because there are so many nice places in the north here.
Do you reckon that you've got one of the best ones right where you are, where we're sitting right now?
Well, it's very nice here, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, but there are more spectacular areas. I mean, this is just sort of flat, featureless country compared to those sort of places.
This place where we're sitting might be flat, but Queensland's third largest mountain is dwarfing us to the east. Lewis Roberts at Shipton's Flat on southern Cape York Peninsula.
My Cape York Life. Great stories from all around Cape York Peninsula. Search Cape York Land Manager on your browser or go to your favourite podcast app and search for My Cape York Life.
Lewis Roberts is widely known and recognised for his expertise, his comprehensive knowledge of Cape York's plants and animals, and his bush skills. And he's highly regarded for his generous sharing of his knowledge and experience. And he may downplay the awards, but he's the recipient of some well-deserved official recognition.
Well, I got an OAM a few years ago, and last year I got the Queensland Naturalist of the Year award. I'm not sure how all this came about, but anyway, I gave a lot of people a bit of help, and I guess they wanted to show some appreciation or something for it, so they nominated me and it went through, so that's how all that happened. I can't think of anything else, but those were the two major ones.
Well, it's pretty significant. You don't get those kind of awards for nothing, so it's a pretty big thing that you've got. So you're very modest about, I think, your achievements over time, but clearly you've done a lot and well recognised for it.
Yeah, well, I'm very thankful to those people for going to all that trouble, and I do feel honoured to receive them, yes.
You flew down to Brisbane?
Yes, that's right. I didn't have to, actually. Patrick Cooper at the museum volunteered to receive it for me. But I wanted to go down there and have a bit of a look around at the wildlife and that around there. And a good friend of mine had died at the, that worked at the museum there, and I sort of never got a chance to go there while she was there. So I thought, well, I would make a bit of a pilgrimage for that as well. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I saw a few new birds and a few new snails and things, so it was nice.
So I guess one of the first things that I wanted to ask was, what makes this place special here at Shipton's Flat? And, again, maybe you could talk us through some of the different species that that are around here that are quite unique to this area.
Well, it's probably not so much that the area is so rich in wildlife. It's just that all these experts come here to see them because this is where we take them around. Yeah, two or three of the orchids that I had described seem to mainly occur around this area, and some of the smaller reptiles too, I guess, including that blind snake as far as is known. But, often when you have something brought to light like that, with experience, people find them elsewhere as well, and it's fairly unusual for something to be confined to a really small area. So, and it has happened that some of these things have been found elsewhere since they were described, because once they're known, people know to look for them elsewhere then. So it's not that unique an environment right here. I mean, it's part of a much larger system, and you mostly find these things are scattered over a much larger area than just Shipton's Flat.
Yep.
But that's where most of the collections were made, because the people studying them or whatever were here and found them here.
Yep.
But you'll probably find that even the ones that haven't yet been found elsewhere will eventually be. Otherwise, I'm not sure how else you could describe that.
Well, it's a bit of a base for people to come, really, isn't it?
Exactly. That's right, exactly. Yeah. That's what it's always been, and we could help them because we knew the area so well. Even if they just needed to get to a certain part of it, we could just take them there because it was easy. We know the country, and that has happened even in areas that I don't know so well, but because you can find your way around one place, you can usually find your way around somewhere else too.
Yeah. There's tree kangaroos here, and what other kind of, what else do we have here in mammals?
Well, tree kangaroos are the one that seems to create the most interest. They are.
And which kind?
Bennett's tree kangaroo. It's the only tree kangaroo in this area. And we have the striped possums, the northern quolls and all those sort of things, but they are found elsewhere as well, of course. But again, people looking for them often come here, so if you read something on them, it's often at Shipton's Flat, and that's the general reason, that's where they came to see them.
I'm just thinking about sort of the broader land management issues for this region and for the rest of the Cape as well. I mean, you're born here and you grew up here, you must have seen some changes over time and different ideas and practices and the way the land is managed. Have you seen much change over time?
Well, yes, everything's always changing, even if it's gradually, and in some cases it's probably just evolution at work, I guess. But, yeah, I guess management practices have changed a little over the years too. One of the most obvious things here is this country used to be all open grassland between the rainforest areas, whereas it's now becoming quite scrubby in between, and the rainforest is spreading into that scrubby stuff. And as a result, a lot of the things that are only found in that area, be mammals, birds or reptiles or orchids or anything, are sort of being squashed out because they don't occur in that thicker habitat. And that's probably the biggest threat to any species just here. But it's not an easy thing to correct, because it's probably just evolution more than anything. There's a bit of the problem is introduced weeds, because they add to it, of course, and we are trying to control that here on our property. But yeah, it's a bit of a complex problem there, I guess.
We're just sitting here and we've got a young cow. What do we got? He's a
little steer
wandering over to say g'day By the creek. It's pretty special.
Yeah, well, the other thing about ours, cattle, they're all pretty quiet, so you can walk up to them and give them a pat if you want to, mostly, although they're not so keen on strangers sometimes. But we need to have them quiet to be able to manage them in this part of the world.
Cattle, it's getting a bit tougher. Seems to be tougher and tougher all the time. The prices are up and down all the time, and I imagine sometimes you'd have some access issues here trying to get cattle out. But do you muster all year round, and are you still able to make a decent living from cattle in this part of the world?
Well, I'm not sure if you'd call it a decent living, but we've made our living out of them all our lives here. It's no great fortune, that's for sure. And as you say, the price goes up and down. We've always sort of been able to live with that. And, yeah, the worst problem we've been having in recent years is this infestation of weeds and very bad dry seasons, I guess, and they have major problems.
Yeah.
Cuts in the road are not so bad. There was that one episode after that cyclone Ida when we couldn't get a truck in here for a year because they didn't fix that culvert up. But otherwise, you know, once the wet's over, the road's usually passable again for the kind of trucks we use. And dry seasons have been our worst problem. We used to always get our storms around November, and that was sort of the end of the dry season. But lately we've been getting really dry weather right to the end of the year, and it's always that last month that makes all the difference.
Mm.
Like I said, when just a week or so back, all this country was brown. There wasn't a speck of green in it. And look at it now, it's just had a week of rain. So at least it comes back quickly. But we had a couple of serious grass fires this year that were deliberately lit too, and then we lost all our dry grass, so we've been bringing in hay and molasses to try and keep them going till the rain came.
And that must be almost unheard of to have to buy in hay in this part of the world.
Well, it normally is here, that's right. We usually have enough old dry grass on it to keep them going until the rain comes. This year was a bit worse than normal for some reason. We did get late rain too, but we didn't get any follow-up rain, and what we did get was so light it wasn't going in very much. And once it dried up, the ground was just totally dry in no time.
And are you seeing that more, did you say, that's been the last couple of years? Or?
Well, for the last 12 or 14 years we've been having drier than normal dry seasons here. I'm not sure why. It's probably just some part of a cycle or something, and we're always hoping that'll just return to normal. But we have had, you know, when we were kids they had some really bad dry seasons here, and our parents used to talk about worse ones they'd seen when they were young, so it's not new, but it's still a bit distressing.
And the weeds that you have around here, what are the problematic ones? Then can you tell us about management of those?
Well, the sickle pod is our worst one because it's been decimating our open pasture, and it's not so bad having to spray it a couple of times, but I've been spraying it for about 20 years and not letting it seed, and it's still coming up. The seed's somehow existing in the soil and we can't seem to get rid of it. I have to go over the whole area every year because if you miss a couple of plants, there's a new crop of seeds. So it's been a very time-consuming effort I've been putting into it, not to mention expensive. But hopefully, sooner or later, it'll stop coming up. There's a few other weeds like lantana, and there's always something new coming in, which I've been trying to jump on before it gets out of hand. The lantana, usually only have to spray it a couple of times, or, you know, sometimes we just remove it physically, and it's fairly easy to get rid of compared to things like sickle pod. But as you can see, we've kept the paddocks fairly clean of it, so, you know, just have to persist at it, I guess.
And I'm just interested, you've got this really fine balance of, you're driven by keeping the country nice and clean and good and as healthy as you can, and you're still making a living off it. Do you think that that's still going to be sustainable into the future, for not just for you but for Cape York in general?
Well, I think so. It'll have to be, won't it? Because the same thing is happening all around the world. We just have to learn how to keep going.
What's the secret to keeping the balance?
Just common sense, I guess. I mean, we had a lot of introduced legumes and that in the paddock, which helped a lot with the stock. But when you spray sickle pod, you kill all those too. So, you know, we've also lost a lot of our feed through spraying it. But we have to get rid of the sickle pod because it becomes a monoculture and smothers everything out. It grows really tall and nothing else can survive with it.
So, we've been asking, the people that we've been talking to, we've been asking just what do you see the future is on Cape York for, what are the things that concern you, what are you seeing, and what do you think the future of living and working on Cape York will be?
Well, that's a kind of hard one to answer. A lot depends on the climate and the kind of pressures that are on the current occupations like ours, because I don't know, people don't seem to be very sympathetic towards graziers and that. The land is all going out of production in a lot of areas, which seems to be a bit of a step backwards to me. I think, you know, the governments and the like should be trying to promote sustainable management of the peninsula and elsewhere, not only the peninsula, because this is countrywide, isn't it? I've been around a fair bit and I see the same problems everywhere you go. And basically the worst it seems to be encroachment of, you know, more built up environments into our farming land and that, which is a never-ending problem all around the world, I guess. But you have to continue producing food for an expanding population, so they'll have to overcome it somewhere. Otherwise, I don't know. There are pressures on the wildlife from certain developments, but usually grazing, for instance, doesn't impact too heavily on the wildlife in the area. I mean, we still have all the same things here we've always had, you know, in my time. There's been a few things kind of vanish out of the more overgrown areas, but like those bees I showed you, they still persist around our paddocks and that, so there's still hope, hopefully.
So you've recently discovered a new species of native bee here, or a new species to here?
Yes, well, we've known about it for 60 years, I guess, but about 2 years ago I was able to show it to some people that were in studying bees, and in a bit of a roundabout way, actually, because the girl that I gave the specimens to was studying the distribution of some eucalypt seeds by these native bees, and I actually gave her a few specimens of this new one, and eventually she gave the head off of one to Anne Dolan, who was the stingless bee expert in Australia, and she recognised it straight away as something totally different after working for 30 years, she said, in the field on those. And she looked into it. At first, I think they thought it was a new species altogether, but then they decided it was one that occurs in New Guinea. So it's Ostroplevia cincta, which is an extension of range from New Guinea, but it has always been here, of course. So, yeah, that was pretty spectacular, I thought.
And you've got some special little houses for them up by the house.
Well, originally I wanted to get one specimen of each one in a box so that if someone like that woman studying the seeds could come up, she could look inside and see the seeds and that without having to disturb a hive, because she couldn't, all they could do was observe them taking the seeds in and out of the entrance and that. And because these bees often come crashing down in branches and that splatter on the ground, we rescue a few of them and put them into boxes. And they're becoming quite popular in Australia now as pollinators and that sort of thing. There's people experimenting with them now. They were actually exporting some of them to America at one stage there, and they think they are better pollinators in some of their situations over there than they are than the honeybees were. So they have potential for pollination purposes. And also the honeybees are having major problems worldwide, so they're looking at producing some of the honey in that as well, because they do produce honey, but in much smaller quantities. And I believe it's very expensive. You can buy it even now, because there are commercial producers further south. These, like this common, this new species, probably wouldn't be suitable for any of those things, but it's still an interesting thing.
And it's quite beautiful, this one, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Compared to all the others, which are just a plain dark colour, it's got beautiful yellow markings all over it, and yeah, it's quite colourful.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure sitting here by the creek on a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful day in Cape York. And thank you very much for having us here, Lewis, at Shipton's Flat.
You're welcome. It's no worries.
Lewis Roberts, among his many talents, is a gift for storytelling. Lewis lives at Shipton's Flat, just south of Cooktown, Cape York Peninsula. My Cape York Life is brought to you by Cape York NRM, with support from South Cape York Catchments and the Australian Government's National Landcare Program. You can find us at Cape York Land Manager or download us from your favourite podcast app. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Lyndall Scoble, and I'll see you next time on My Cape York Life.